You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I am Alex here at Baltimore Comic Con in Artist Alley with the amazing, always amazing, Tony Fleece. Tony, welcome.
Very happy to be here. I think this is my first time being back since we corrected the name pronunciation.
Yes, were you waiting for me to mess it up?
I had my fingers crossed, yeah. But I feel like you guys have been pretty good about it.
Yes, tried really hard. Pete actually just left. You just missed him. But he has been working hard on correcting me every time. Even when I say it correctly.
That's okay. Everyone gets it wrong. I do not care, but I noticed that you guys wanted to do it right.
So we appreciate it.
I'm happy to steer people in the right direction if they care about that sort of thing. I have built with too much shame to ever correct anyone. So, yeah.
Great. And that's pretty much all I wanted to talk to you about.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. This has been great.
All right. No, seriously, though, you have a lot of stuff going on, but I do want to start with something that I always kind of like to start with when we're at cons. How is this going? What is your goal when you're at a place like Baltimore Comic Con?
Baltimore, I've been at this show a few times, and Trish, who draws Feral and Stray Dogs, is from here. She lives here. And so at a show like this, a lot of it is just like signing the books that people in this area buy and just sort of like doing like almost like reader outreach, like just reminding them that we appreciate them buying the book. So we out here, I sign a ton of books, and I don't charge for signatures, especially on creator owned stuff, because I feel like already those people are putting money in my pocket, and so they're sort of the reason why I can have more freedom to make the kind of choices I want to make, because they support my independent stuff. So yeah, I just like to come out to a show like this and see readers mostly. There's some retailers I'll run into, and I like hanging out with other creators, but at a show like this, it's mostly just seeing old readers and signing books and selling stuff to new readers, like bringing Feral and Stray Dog trades and selling those to try and get new people reading the book.
It's interesting to hear you say that. We were having a little discussion on the Comic Book Club Discord about the whole signature thing, particularly after New York Comic Con in particular. Do you find, I'm not asking you to call anybody out, do you find people take advantage of it, or are people respectful of, like, your time in terms of signing?
No, I think charging for signatures is fine, but I just, like, for where I'm at in my career, I feel like I'm still building something.
Sure.
And it's so important to me to not reward, but, like, just say thank you to people who are buying, like I said, especially my creator-owned stuff. And that sort of extends to, like, you know, if they bought the thing or if they, you know, I'm always just so grateful that people seek out my stuff. And so for now, I mean, I reserve the right to sell out at any moment, you know, in this economy. I'll be charging for signatures by the end of the show. But
yeah,
but right now, yeah, it's easier for me to just sign the books and tell people thank you.
I can probably figure out the answer just based on you sitting next to Trish, like you said, booth to booth. But is there anything people are bringing to you more than others, or getting you to sign more than others? Like, what's been the big hit for you of the con?
Stray Dogs and Feral.
Yeah.
I think it's probably still Stray Dogs. We did so many of those reprints and retailer covers for that book. So it's, I mean, there's only seven and a half issues of Stray Dogs, but there's probably 220 Stray Dogs covers you could get signed. You know, like, it was a It was a real happening. That pandemic was wild.
Yeah. Let me ask you a quick question about Stray Dogs. Yeah. Is there any movement on the animated movie?
Not really. Okay. It's sort of like it was optioned by Paramount early in the run. Like when it was still coming out, and it feels like they're probably not going to make it. And so we've talked to some other studios about it, but it's just, it's a matter of somebody taking a swing on a, you know, maybe not R, but like at least PG-13 rated horror cartoon that deals with real adult themes. And there hasn't really been one of those, you know, there's like Plague Dogs and, but that's, you know, 40 years ago. And so there's, a lot of times in movies, you see how movies come out. You know, it's sequels, it's remakes, it's stuff they can point to and go like, well, this made money before, it will make money again. Or, you know, they made money on Fast and the Furious, we can make movies like Fast and the Furious. Yeah. So I would love to be the adult animated cartoon that comes out that makes money and people go, oh, we could do something like that.
Right.
We should, you know, but it feels like what needs to happen is somebody makes a different animated cartoon for adults, like a Demon Slayer. That's the thing. There's like an animated adult thing that makes money, and it's made in Japan, right?
Yeah.
So there's a real disconnect there. Like, that's not the same. So yeah, it's chilling right now. At some point, we'll get it cracked, and they'll do something with it. But you know, we always sort of went into it making it exactly how we wanted it to be in the comics. That's why it looks like that. We were like, even if it was a movie, the odds of them doing like a 2D animated Don Bluth looking, you know, they're so slim that it's like, let's just make it exactly how we want it. And then if nothing else ever happens, we have the exact thing we wanted. And so the comic is the thing for us. And, you know, if they make a movie, we love money. We love freedom. So that shit would be great. But, you know, for right now, we're happy just, you know, selling people this comic. And it's next year is going to be 5 years of Stray Dogs.
Oh, wow.
5 years since Stray Dogs number one. I guess we haven't been doing Stray Dogs the whole time, but we're going to do some cool Stray Dog stuff next year. So
awesome. Well, let's move on from dogs to cats and talk about Feral. I was writing up a quickly little thing for our 31 Days of Halloween today.
Nice.
And was like, man, this title's been running for a while. Like, you, and I say this laudably, like, keep going with it. Keep finding new iterations of ways of torturing these cats.
Yeah.
And in fact, this is a mild spoiler here for anybody who hasn't been reading the book, but the current arc, which finds the cats inside an enormous pet store, is probably the most horrifying one so far. What keeps you going? What keeps going back to that well and iterating it in new and more awful ways?
Well, I hate cats, and I just...
Great.
No. I really, truly love zombie stories, you know? Like, and I love the Romero series. Like, I love all of those. And I just think about, you know, survival, infection, horror stuff all the time. And so... looking at it through the point of view of cats sort of really opens up all these new opportunities for, like, you know, these cats, you know, can't get through a door if it's closed in some cases, you know, like if it's a sliding door, they're totally screwed. If it has the right kind of handle, they can sort of work it, but like they're sort of in more danger and they're more inconvenienced by the world shutting down than people even would be. So, just sort of coming up with scenarios for them to be in. And also, we sort of come upon like cat specific things a lot of the time that are like, this is great for this scenario that we've made. Like, we have a cat that's declawed, and so like he's at more of a disadvantage even than the other cats. Or, you know, we had the cat lady arc where they sort of ran up against the person that was like brain riddled with toxoplasmosis, where they, you know, like they have too many cats around and they've sort of like driven themselves crazy. And so we're constantly looking for stuff like that, like trying to think up new like ways to make cat stuff work in a horror space. And when I land on one of those, I get so excited about it where I'm just like, oh, this is great because this is real and people will be able to lock in with it and be like, I know exactly what that is and how horrifying if it happened, you know, in XYZ or whatever.
Yeah.
So like the thing that they're doing in this new arc that's truly horrifying is just a thing that stray cats do all the time. But it's like, well, if we just have them talk about it, it's going to be real messed up, you know?
There was one thing I had a question for you about that happens in this arc that has nothing to do with the horrific stuff.
Yeah.
there is a scene, I want to say it was two issues back, where two cats make out. And it's sure, like, they make out like humans.
Like people, yeah.
Yeah, do cats do that?
No. okay. We had to really go back and forth about, like, how that was going to work. Because the problem is, so we set up some sort of, like, soap opera dynamics in this one. There's a tomcat who's sort of tomcatting his way through our main cast. And we wanted to show them sort of, like, getting into this first a love triangle, and then as it goes on, like, sort of more than a triangle. But if you just show them, like, nuzzling with each other like cats do, it doesn't have quite the, like, the oomph to it that you need for, like, a, oh, these two are hooking up.
Yeah.
You know, like, they could just be being compassionate towards each other or just being nice to each other. So I felt like we had to sort of do it. And that, weirdly, is when... my email inbox sort of changed tones. Like a whole new readership found me when the cats started to make out like people do. So, yeah.
That... Have the commissions for Trish changed at all?
not so far as I know.
Okay.
I think she might have been able to filter out all the porny sort of like anthro commissions before we even started this. But who knows?
Yeah. Do you... This is a terrible way to frame it, but, like, do you have an end game in mind for this title, or like The Walking Dead, does it feel like the sort of thing where it could just go on and on?
I feel like I have a sort of place where I'd like it to end up. I have an ending that, you know, like, we know, like, what the stakes are at the ending and like, how it all wraps up. But I'm always sort of, like, we've got these, we're jumping from lily pad to lily pad. I have these story spots that I want to hit and these ideas, and they're going to be in this place and they're going to be in this place. We're going to explore this sort of thing. We're going to meet this sort of character. So I know where we're going and we're hitting a bunch of these spots along the way, but it's also open up enough for us to be able to, like, sort of freestyle a little bit and improvise, which has been fun because Stray Dogs was real tightly plotted even before we drew the first page of it, you know, like we knew exactly what was happening from issue one to issue five. And in this one, it's obviously, we're hoping to do like 60 issues more if it's, you know, if it's selling like crazy when we're at 60, but that seems like very wishful thinking, you know, like so few books get to go on for that long nowadays. But yeah, plotting out a whole 60 issue thing, if you're not Jonathan Hickman, is sort of like much too big for somebody to take on. So we have, like I said, a bunch of places where we're going to land, and then I know where we're eventually going to land at the end. So we're just having a good time getting there.
Yeah. Let's move over to some Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
You just finished up a run on The Thing.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I really loved about that series, one, I think it was in the first issue, and this came out around-ish the same time as the movie, where it really crystallized for me. I was like, oh, I love The Thing. I didn't realize how much I love The Thing until I was reading your series. And part of that is, like, you showed off the malleability of the character. He's very much often like, hey, I'm the goofy guy in the background. Here, you give him a solo adventure, but it was much more down-to-earth and much more... There's fun to be had, but it's much more serious. What was behind that particular take?
I was the same. Like, they pitched me the idea of writing The Thing, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I had never really thought of myself as like a... I didn't have a Thing story in my back pocket ready to go. And I started working on ideas for it, and I was like, oh, I like this character a lot. And I really saw a lot of myself in him. Mm-hmm. And some of that is sort of like giving him, you know, like... a story to deal with in this story that felt a little like more grounded, and but also like he's sort of contending with his childhood bully in this thing, and so I got to deal with sort of like more of his interiority and sort of like, you know, since Stan and Jack, like, it's been about his sort of like dysmorphia, you know, like he's just like a guy that doesn't like the way his body is, you know. And I've been fat my whole life. Like, I can obviously identify with that. Luckily, I'm not covered in rocks, but it's all just as bad, nearly. You know, like, in the inside of my head, I might as well be covered in spikes. So I could definitely do a lot of that sort of, like, here's this guy that's just trying to, you know, like, he's giving the world the best that he can possibly give them, while on the inside just being like, fuck, I wish I didn't look like this. And so that's the sort of headspace I was in when I was writing it, and just, like, coming up with a fun adventure to put that guy on. and sort of like how he relates to other people. And then we introduce this character, Sarah, who's like this little girl who's the MacGuffin, or like the person that he's chasing in the story, and or not chasing, but like rescuing in the story. And sort of like showing him dealing with her. And that was sort of a lot of like me talking to my nieces and stuff, and just sort of like Ben as like an uncle character, and like a cool, like older, you know, not parental, but like definitely like an uncle. Cause I love those stories when it's like him and Val, or like him and Franklin. And so just sort of like being able to put something like that into this and just sort of show that side of him. And then also just have it be chock-a-block full of like Marvel villains, and him being able to go, you know, like fight as many of my favorite Marvel villains, and then just, you know, like leading up to I thought I came up with a really fun answer to what clobbering time is, and just sort of like getting to sort of build that into it. And I was just really happy with that whole thing came out. Justin Mason really drew the shit out of it, and Alex Sinclair colored it up great, and it just came out really, I'm really happy with it, especially for my first like solo Marvel thing. I felt good to be like, oh, this is exactly what I like. This is what I want.
You mentioned this while you were talking about it, but I love the conceit of meeting this guy in the first issue who was Ben Grimm's bully before he was the Thing, because he's a new character, but you instantly hate him but feel bad for him at the same time. Yeah. It's just like such a nice way of snapping in that character.
Yeah, he's like a loser.
Right.
But you know, growing up he was tougher than this one kid, you know.
Yeah. You have another Marvel thing coming up though, which is Omega Kids, right? Part of the Age of Revelation event. Before we even get to that, this is such an interesting rollout for this event. What is it like? What was it like getting involved in this and the coordination of this?
So this is the same editor as The Thing.
Okay.
Darren Shan. And we get along really well, and we work together really well. And he just, you know, as The Thing was wrapping up, he was like, hey, can you pitch us some ideas for this Quentin Quire book? It's called Omega Kids, which right away I was like, oh, what a great name. You know, like, what a clever idea for a Quentin Quire book. That's pretty much how getting involved with it went. I came up with three or four pitches, and just sort of like trying to put myself in the place of this guy who now it's 10 years in the future. We know what he was like as a kid and what he's been like sort of as like a young adult, and sort of like what's he like. The age doesn't work out right, but I just sort of thought of him as like a, you know, like a elder millennial or like a Gen X guy now, and he's sort of like trying to relate to these young kids. Like, I don't know why I always do like superheroes hanging out with kids, but that's fun, right? Like, there's so many great comics where like a superhero and a kid have to go on an adventure together. I don't know. Maybe I'm stunted, but that's fun to me. So, so I wrote this miniseries about Quentin Quire, who works in this world for Revelation. So he's like on the bad side of an Age of Apocalypse situation. Yeah. And so, but just sort of writing it from his perspective where he thinks he's completely right. And we don't really do him. It's not about him discovering that like, oh no, we're the bad guys. It's just about him being like working for Revelation and having these kids who are like now the Quentin Quires to Quentin Quire. They're the young punks that this young punk has to deal with.
Not to keep hammering on what I said earlier, and I know this is part and parcel of working in a big superhero universe, and maybe the answer is it's up to the editors to figure this out, but for anybody listening who doesn't know, you've got an intro issue, 16 three-part miniseries, and then a closing issue that all take place not just 10 years in the future of the Marvel Universe, but also, I think we started to see this in the second week a lot more, there's things that happened like 5 years in, 6 years in, 7 years in. There's a lot of moving parts in there. So how much does that affect the process of how you're plotting?
Well, we did this. So we did Venom War, me and Tim Seeley, last year. And our plan there was just to get Wolverine as far away from Venom War as possible so that he can have a Venom-y adventure off in the distance. And that was sort of the move here, too, was just like when we're first putting it together, they send out all the documents, you know, Jed McKay's running this thing and he put together like, here's what this person's doing. Here's what that person's doing. So I have I have the roadmap for what's going on. But then as for mine, it's just like, all right, we'll just try and take place in this little corner over here. But it is interesting because we do stuff in the book where it's just like, well, I am sure other books would realize that this was happening, you know, but I'm definitely sure nobody's like, does this work with what Omega Kids are doing? Like, I'm so low on the crossover totem pole that I don't think, you know, Jonathan Hickman's checking in to be like, is Quentin's book going to be okay? So it's just like a fun three-issue story, and it's in like, hopefully you can read the front page of it and know like, okay, this is what's going on in the rest of the world. I know who Quentin Quire is. I have a basic idea of what the Revelation situation is. I can read this and just sort of, you know, enjoy meeting these new characters and seeing how Quentin and whatever surprise people we decide to throw in the book are in 10 years in the future.
So that's this week at Marvel, but I want to talk about something both a little last weekend and far off. I was in the DC KO What's Next panel.
Oh, hold on. Before we move over, move across the street.
Yes.
The one thing that I'm very excited for people to see about Quentin in this upcoming book is how handsome he grew up to be.
Oh,
he's a
true,
like, he's like a daddy. Like, he's got like a pink beard. And he's just like, Andreas Genolet is drawing this book, and Fernando Cifuentes colors it. And Quentin Quire has never looked more handsome. he really filled out.
Were you doing that for the cosplayers?
I don't know. I'm not sure why he did it. I was just like, man, this guy's handsome. Ryan Stegman designed all the characters, and I was just terrified because they had done like a future Quentin before in like the Krakoa, the X-Force run that he was in, and he looked like a crazy wizard with like one tooth.
Right, he had like a super long beard.
And I was like, I can't write a whole book about somebody looking this silly. And so he's got these goggles on for most of the time because he wears glasses, you know, but at some point Andreas like flips the goggles up and you're just like, oh my goodness. Holy cow, look at this guy. So even if you don't care about Quentin Quire, if you just like handsome pink-haired guys, you know, tune in for that too.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Who doesn't? I look forward, we'll see the cosplayers at next Baltimore Comic Con. Moving over to the other side of the street,
the
room at DCKO, that panel was nuts. People were losing their minds the entire time. They announced...
Never more so, I'm sure, than when they saw...
Well, one of the big announcements was DC Next Level, which I was sitting there, you know, doing my little transcribing thing, and I was like, I cannot believe that we're one issue into DCKO, and they're like, by the way, here's what happens 5 months into the future.
Yeah.
That's crazy. But the way that they sold this, and you correct me if this is how they sold it to you, is DC Next Level is giving creators either they haven't worked with a while or are top tier or they want to give their shot, but they came to people who are like, shoot your shot.
Yeah.
This is what do you want to do? So is that, were they lying?
No, that's pretty much it.
I
mean, they came to me with a couple of characters, and one of them was the character, I'm trying very hard not to say the character because they're going to reveal that at their own pleasure. But yeah, they said, like, give us your take on these. And I sort of came up with a thing and we kicked some stuff back and forth. And it's been like an interesting, like, developing it thing. But yeah, they want me to do it with my voice. They want me to tell a story in the regular DC universe with this character that sort of like feels like it's one of my books.
Yeah.
And I'm super excited about it just because that's, it's hard to say. Cause like I'm a independent comic book creator, right? Like I make Stray Dogs, I make Feral, I make Local Man. Like that's my job. Like as far as I'm concerned, like that's my job. That's the business that I run. And everything else is like, how do I get people to come into my business, right? Mm-hmm. So doing the thing, doing X-Men books and stuff like that, that's like, let's go build people up. Does the Kirkman Manifesto still work? Can I go build people up and bring them back to my Image books? But I also love superhero comics. Like, I've read comics my whole life, so I'm like, I want to make awesome ones of those. And even having made Local Man, I've always said, like, if you're going to make superhero comics, go make them at Marvel and DC because... they have all the best characters, and you can, you know, like, no matter how cool your Homelander or your Samaritan or whatever is, like, there's nothing like just being able to have Superman show up, right? You know, like, that means exactly what it says. You know, Superman shows up, people know what's going on. So I'm very excited to get to do something cool in the DC universe, and they are truly like getting, I mean, you saw like with the names that they announced, mine's like a waha compared to all the rest of those, you know, like I wrote the Super Pets at DC, and this is not that, this is different from that. And so, yeah, it's like Scotty Young's doing Lobo, Greg Rucka's coming back and doing Batwoman, and they're just doing, like, cool sort of creator-forward stuff, and that's what I'm interested in doing. Like, I love superhero comics, but I hope to not be doing, like, oh, I'm doing two issues of Teen Titans or whatever. Mm-hmm. No disrespect to people that run, that like, that's their gig, and they can fill in on two issues of Teen Titans, but I feel like it behooves me to bring people into my own stuff, and I can do that by saying, like, here's the kind of story I tell. It's like this. You know this character. Here's what I have to say about it. And, yeah. I don't know. Does that make sense?
No, it absolutely makes sense, and we've talked about this a lot on the show since all the way since last weekend, but my feeling on it as a person who has read comic books my entire life is I would rather see somebody shoot their shot on a character like a Firestorm or Zatanna or even somebody lower down the totem pole and be like, this is my take. This is the thing that I want to go for. Maybe it doesn't work, but pair together a writer and artist who want to work together, are excited about the same yeah. thing, rather than feeling like, here's more product for you to chew on, yeah. you know?
Yeah, here's this thing that you've seen before. You like it? We made more of it, you know? yeah, this is not that. This is like they're looking for unique voices and they want them to do their unique thing, which is cool.
I don't know if you could talk about this part of it, but they, like you noted, haven't announced too many of the teams.
Yeah.
But you got Greg Rucka and Danny. You've got Scotty Young and Jorge Corona.
Yeah.
You've got Josh Williamson and ... on Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah.
But it certainly seems like people who either know each other and excited to work with each other, or people who have worked together before. Is that something we potentially could expect from your title?
Oh, like, is Trish going to draw?
Sure.
No, this is, they just last week locked in an artist on the thing, and we've never worked together before, but I'm a big fan of their stuff, so I'm excited about it.
All right, I won't push you too much on
and
it.
And out here at this show, even, they're, like, lining up cover artists that I'm just like, holy shit, crazy, awesome. You know, so, yeah.
Not to keep big upping them, but I really feel like DC is taking a art-forward approach right now.
Yeah.
Which often takes second or sometimes third shift in this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it's good. I'm glad to see it.
I mean, as a writer, I find it all disrespectful, but as a writer-artist, I'm just fine with it.
Yeah. Is the artist you? The artist you worked with?
No, man. Okay. That'd be much better money, but no, it's not me.
Yeah. That's a lot of stuff, and that's a lot of exciting stuff that's coming up. What else do you want to tease, if anything? Or a plug?
Let's see. I've got a bunch of trades that come out in February. The Thing trade comes out in February. The new volume of Feral, the one that's going on right now, comes out in February. And Uncanny Valley Volume 2 comes out in February. And then in March, I think that should be the DC book, and it's going to be a real big month for Feral. And then I have another book that Tim Seeley and I are working together on that we're hoping to be springtime, but we're both... I mean, Tim's doing as much other stuff as I am, probably more.
Tim's schedule, I was talking with somebody about this earlier today. His schedule is crazy.
He's a lunatic, yeah. He works a full-time job as a teacher as well. Like, he's
what?
Just, yeah, he teaches comic books at a university, and then he writes more comics than anyone I know. And he's, this thing we're working on, he's drawing. So it's like, he's a nut. But we're cooking up something that's very cool. You guys are going to dig it when it comes out. It's at the same time, like, we'll be familiar to people that have read both of our stuff, but we're also taking a really big swing that is that's pretty exciting to me, where I'm just like, if we can make this work, it's a thing that you've rarely seen work. And so I'm just like, I think we're both in our bag right now. I think we can really do this. So we'll see. See if we can do it.
Awesome. I think you can. I believe in you. Tony, always great chatting with you.
Alex, thank you.
Enjoy the rest of the con.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Comic book drama. If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.